Thank you, Rabbi Silber. We're actually doing well. We're exactly on time, and we're going to go to the next phase of our program, which is an adult case study. So what I'd like to do is call on Dr. Aaron Rappaport, professor of hematology oncology at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and Medical Center, who will present the case. Following the case, I'll invite a panel from the various different professional groups that are here today to come up front, and we'll have a panel discussion. So, Aaron, thank you for putting this together for us.
Thank you, Dr. Zinn. Thank you, Rabbi Silber. Thank you for everyone involved in this very, very exciting program. It's a privilege to be here with you and to present hopefully a provocative story of a very courageous patient. Let me just say also that this is the synopsis of this case is in your packet, although it is identified as a patient BR, whereas in my slides I use NK, and that's to thoroughly confuse you as to the identity of the patient. So I'm not going to tell you which is right. So again, this is a challenging lymphoma in a very courageous young woman, medical and ethical dimensions. The patient was a 35-year-old woman from Russia, who gave birth to a healthy baby girl in July of 2012. About 2 months after her daughter's birth, in September, the patient developed left shoulder pain and a right breast mass. About 1 month later, she developed night sweats and fevers and weight loss while the mass in the breast grew to the size of a lemon. A biopsy of the breast mass revealed a very high-grade, rapidly growing lymphoma, which involved the breast and the left upper arm, as well as lymph nodes in the chest and in the abdomen. Let me digress by just giving you a little background as to what lymphoma is. Lymphoma is a form of blood cancer that typically grows in the lymph nodes or lymph glands, causing enlargement and often pain. This entity can occur in any organ of the body, including the skin, the bones, the marrow, lungs, liver, brain, etc. It usually is treated with multi-agent chemotherapy, and there are many different subtypes that have been described, but even advanced stage disease can be cured as a result of treatment with multi-agent chemotherapy. However, about a third of the patients have recurrences or relapses that require additional treatments, including sometimes bone marrow or stem cell transplants. Starting in November of 2012, this patient received chemotherapy, after which the treatment was switched to a more intensive regimen, along with injections of chemotherapy into the spinal fluid to treat or prevent lymphoma in the brain. And the reason was because the lymphoma was so aggressive, the likelihood of extension into the brain, the fluid around the brain, was considered to be very high. And so this was a very standard approach to trying to prevent that complication. The patient and her husband did extensive research and obtained multiple opinions from at least a dozen blood cancer specialists over the course of her illness. The recommendations ranged from watchful waiting and postponement of stem cell transplantation until a relapse of the lymphoma occurred, or proceeding to some type of bone marrow or stem cell transplantation right away. Now, after initial chemotherapy, radiology studies showed that the patient had gone into a complete remission. There was no sign of detectable lymphoma, and this was in April of 2013. However, just a month later, in May of 2013, she developed neurological symptoms, including numbness and weakness in her legs. and an MRI scan showed evidence of lymphoma in the spinal nerves as well as in the bones. And a spinal fluid examination showed the presence of lymphoma cells in the cerebral spinal fluid, which is the fluid that bathes the brain and the spinal cord. The patient was given additional chemotherapy and went back into remission, but this was expected to be very short-lived, and thus allogeneic or donor stem cell transplantation was recommended, and a well-matched unrelated donor stem cell donor was sought. Now, allogeneic or stem cell transplantation is a form of treatment that is used to treat patients with relapsed or highly resistant forms of lymphoma. In this case, the patient did not have any matched siblings, brothers or sisters, who could be used as a donor, and thus a well-matched unrelated donor was sought and identified through the National Marrow Donor Program. And in November of 2013, the patient received high doses of treatment consisting of total body radiation and high-dose chemotherapy, followed by an infusion of the unrelated donor cells. And the idea was that the high-dose treatment would hopefully help to eradicate the lymphoma, and the healthy cells from the donor would rebuild her blood counts and also provide important immune cells that would help to cure the and eradicate the lymphoma. Fortunately, the patient had prompt blood count recovery and was discharged from the hospital. However, around day 100 after transplant, signs of the lymphoma relapse developed in the bone marrow and the blood, and this was confirmed by a pathology review. The discussion was held with the patient's husband about transitioning his wife to comfort care, introducing a DNR order, but he refused. His refusal caused difficulties with the care team. The relapse of lymphoma after allogeneic or donor stem cell transplantation is almost never curable, especially when patients have other complications of transplant, as this patient did, such as graft versus host disease. The patient's husband was constantly at his wife's bedside and every day scoured the medical literature looking for information that might help his wife. He could not bring himself to accept any limitation on her care, despite her profound and probably permanent neurological deficits and the incurability of her lymphoma. And I should say also that following the transplant and following the relapse of the lymphoma, other complications ensued that led to further neurological deficits, including paralysis on one side of the patient's body, as well as impaired speech, inability to communicate verbally. A new oral medication, partly as a result of the husband's research as well as some recommendations from her care team, a new oral medication was started, which caused some regression of the lymphoma, but after a couple of weeks, the patient became too weak to swallow the medication safely. The patient became progressively more impaired neurologically and less responsive, and a discussion and disagreement centered around whether the patient should receive nutrition through a feeding tube and whether the patient should receive intensive care, including possible intubation. About 4 months after the transplant and about a month after her relapse, her condition worsened, and the husband reluctantly agreed to make her DNR, and she soon passed away. So prior to convening the discussion group, let me just highlight some of the discussion points that this patient's story raises. Number one, the patient's husband was unwilling to accept the reality of his wife's terminal situation and unwilling to sign a DNR certification. How do we deal with situations like this? And if at some point the patient was actually declared brain dead, what are the implications of and procedures for removing life support? Number two, is there a moral, legal, and medical obligation for physicians to perform heroic measures, that is CPR, countershocks, intubation, and so forth, to a patient with terminal cancer if her husband and if her family refuses to agree to the recommendations of comfort and hospice care? And finally, what estimate of long-term survival is acceptable to continue ICU-level technology for the patients like this patient? Should there be any limitation on the use of expensive interventions such as stem cell transplantation or expensive medications that only slightly prolong life? It is fair to say that the nature of her lymphoma was such that the likelihood of the success of the transplant was not particularly high, but was also not zero. And later in her course, when the medication was started prior to her death, this was a very, very new and very expensive medication, the cost of which ran about $10,000 per week. And was this justified given her condition? So I'll close here. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. What we're going to do next is I'm going to invite a group of our audience to come up as panelists to discuss the case. If I could ask Dr. John Cagle from the School of Social Work, Dr. Henry Brehm from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Diane Hoffman, Dr. Mary Lynn McPherson from the School of Pharmacy. Diane Hoffman is from the School of Law, and Dr. Anita Tarzian from the School of Nursing, if you could all please come up. And we will have a panel discussion about that case. While everyone is finding their seats, I would like to just take a moment to point out to everybody that we thought long and hard about the two cases that we wanted to present today. And we appreciate that there are many end-of-life issues that perhaps are specific to the elderly, and we did not choose a case like that. But we do think that the two cases that we're presenting to you today really do highlight and raise the issues that are very similar to those that come up with end-of-life care for the elderly. So I apologize if you were hoping for a case on an elder patient, but I do hope that you'll find both of these cases address many of the issues that are common to all of those situations, so that this will be a meaningful experience for everybody. So I think what I'd like to do, so that to limit my involvement here, is perhaps if we could start on the right-hand side, John, with your comments, and if you could each take 8 to 10 minutes to discuss the case from your particular perspectives and your professional backgrounds, and then we should have some time for questions at the end. So, John, I'll let you take it away and keep passing the mic in that direction.
Thank you very much. I'm John Cagle from the School of Social Work here at the University of Maryland. First of all, it's an honor, and I think when we take a look at cases like this, it's important to acknowledge that these are based on real situations, and I am deeply grateful to both the health professionals that presented the case and that worked on the case, and to the families that actually endured through the experience. And so I think it's important to acknowledge that.
Can you speak up, please?
Sure, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
In cases like this, for me, bring up more questions. Questions that the case generated for me, and perhaps we can have a more in-depth discussion about some of these issues. And the first question is, what do we know about this patient's preferences? What can we glean from her history? What was documented in the chart that might give us clues about her preferences? What does the husband know about decisions she's made in the past related to healthcare that might inform future decision making about what her preferences were? Also, what is the meaning of hope? The husband mentioned that he was against giving up hope. means different things to different people. And I would really like to explore what he meant by hope. Is this hope for a full recovery? Is this hope for immortality, which isn't realistic? Is this hope for comfort and quality of life? There's also a sense that when tragedy occurs, we need to do something. We need to take an active role to make things better, to change things. Even when there's a zero chance of improving things, we want to do something to make it better. And how does that desire to do something feed into this gentleman's push for aggressive care at the very end? So exploring that is another question. I also have questions about context. And when we work with families in a clinical setting, we are just meeting with them at a brief moment in this long history that they've had. And so I would want to know more about what the relationship was like between the husband and the wife. I'd want to know more about the belief system, the coping resources, culture, and how those inform both coping and decision. What are the uncertainties? I think in the medical setting, quite often there's an assumption of that we have a lot of facts, we have a lot of certainties, we know everything, there's evidence to guide our decision making, but in reality, there are many questions about the successes and failures of outcomes. We don't have a crystal ball in the clinical context, and it's important to acknowledge that. We don't know, in many cases, what the outcomes are. That can be a scary conversation to have, to say, we just don't know. Or, sure, we kind of know, but we don't know for sure. Another question, what are the expectations? This is probably related to the question of hope, but in life, we have these tacit assumptions that older individuals die and younger individuals live. And in this case, this tacit assumption about how the world should work was shattered. And I think it's important to acknowledge that and dig deeper to find out what this gentleman's expectation was. Also, did he fully understand the risks and benefits of treatment? Did he realize what sort of impact, negative or positive, these treatments have on quality of life, what these treatments would have on functionality, longevity. And lastly, before I pass the mic on, what are the preferences and personal biases of the healthcare team? The healthcare team brings their own set of assumptions and beliefs to the clinical setting, and how does that impact the interaction and decision-making, the shared decision? So those are some of the questions I had. I'm looking forward to a very lively discussion. And I'd like to pass the mic.
I'm Henry Graham. I am a neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins and spent my career helping patients with brain tumors and directly malignant brain tumors and metastatic brain tumors. And so I've spent the last 30 years on the faculty of helping people similar to this patient deal with devastating events and eventually leading to their death almost inevitably. I will say that it is, you know, a privilege that we're having this conversation, and it's a multidisciplinary conversation, and also a pleasure it is that Dr. Silver, Rabbi Silver, poor doctor, so we're your parents. I did that only for the benefit of your parents. And I'm always enlightened by your industry very much the comments that you made at the beginning in terms of what different interests people bring to bear in terms of survival versus the comfort of the patient. I think that the situation with this particular woman really represents, firstly, is a tragedy, of course, at every level. When a young woman has a baby and then is stricken by this horrific fate. But the as a physician, as for my situation as a neurosurgeon, I feel my obligation when I initially, and at different stages, there are different discussions that need to happen, are really balancing hope and reality. It's very important, certainly at the initial stages and at every stage, to maintain a sense of hope, because otherwise, sort of, ball game's over altogether at any stage. So people need a sense of that there is a survivability, there is a way out, or a path that they can take that's reasonable. When facing patients with malignant gliomas, explain initially that these statistics, when people ask, well, what's the likelihood I'm going to live a year, what's the likelihood I'm going to live 5 years, I explain that the statistics are actually meaningless for an individual person. That if you look at a Kaplan-Meier survival curve, the curves drop down very dramatically, and some people are still alive going out at a distance. And my initial approach, someone who's in good condition, as she was when she first started, would be that I can't tell who it is that will survive and do well, and that my obligation to her is to do everything humanly possible to make her one of the people that are the exception. And in fact, it doesn't even matter, I explain to people, it doesn't matter if 99% of people survive 10 years and 1% die, or 1% survive and 99 die. It doesn't predict what's going to happen to you as an individual. And therefore, let's go on the assumption that you're going to be one of the survivors and do everything together that we can to get to that point. Now, in having that initial conversation, I've also introduced the fact that some people die from this and that I'm acknowledging that, and that the person himself is coming to the awareness that, yes, some people do die. We're going to try not to make that person. So I think there is this balance constantly between hope and the evolving reality of the person's situation. And I think initially the news is so devastating that the focus is on the hopeful side. And there's no data to contradict that for an individual person. I think the key issue here is communication. In the way the report's written, it sounds like the husband is the spokesman in the communications with the husband. I would try very hard to make sure, and I assume that in fact it was not that way, but that the communication is with the patient, and that in the course of helping her get through the initial steps, one learns her value system and her desires and where she's at in terms of what needs to be done, and also the complexity of her relationship with her husband. Is he truly her spokesman, and do they speak at the same, or they have the same goals? I also very early on have a conversation very early on with my patients, saying that I will go on the assumption that you will be a survivor and do everything humanly possible, make every treatment available, regardless of cost, regardless of likelihood, as long as there's a realistic chance that there'll be good quality of life and that there's a reasonable chance of survival. And I also say in that same conversation that I also feel that it is my moral obligation as your physician to help you if we reach a point that this is no longer a beneficial direction to go, that I will help you be comfortable and help you approach let me know if you see things differently so that we can discuss them. And that hopefully is with the patient herself and not necessarily with the husband present. Ultimately, as things evolve here, the patient seems to be less of a participant and the focus is on the husband as it has to be. Although, you know, it says initially she's nonverbal, but that doesn't mean non-communicative, at least in my world, for neurologic problems. Nonverbal does not mean non-communicative. And sometimes someone who's aphasic can still be very clear that they're suffering and they want to get back off rather than be more aggressive, and I think that needs to be taken into account. So I think the key things are getting a discussion of the values, having a plan and a big picture of how sort of end-of-life issues will be dealt with. I also think that it's critically important, and there's not much mention of it here, not that it didn't happen, it's just not mentioned here, is to early on about social work, psychiatry, where it's appropriate, and to bring in other groups that can help sort of get people to deal with the complexity of the problems that they and the families will be facing. I think that, you know, the issue in this case is particularly complex because when she failed, there's also an issue of stroke and a hemorrhage in the brain. And again, in my world, that's a different problem than the cancer recurring because strokes in 35-year-olds have a very high likelihood of recovery. So although the patient looks to be in a very bad situation, the stroke itself is, without knowing more details, is frequently a recoverable situation. So that needs to be taken out of the equation and focus on the cancer progression itself. The final issues about the comfort levels and the husband disagreeing. Firstly, in the way Dr. Rappaport explained today, one way or the other, the patient passed away a month after that discussion occurred. And I agree with all the previous speakers that should never be the last discussion that happens. Those discussions need to take place much earlier. But I do think that at the point that there is a disagreement, that there are, again, other resources. It's palliative care, which should have been put in very early on. They are very expert, at least our specialists, at explaining to the family that the benefit to the patient is not necessarily trying the next chemotherapy or toxic therapy or operation, but rather that maybe serving the patient best by introducing palliative care. So I think that my fundamental things that both and reality are a constant balance and a constant living test. As long as there's an honest and open discussion, multidisciplinary and several patients seems incredibly individual and difficult situations best.
Perfect, thank you. You know, I'm going to ask that we change the order slightly based on Dr. Brehm's comments. Might be more appropriate for Lynn McPherson to talk about from the perspective of pharmacy and pharmacology, and then we'll get back to law and nursing. So I apologize, but it may work better this way. So.
Very left brain kind of guy, very evidence based, wants everything done. So how do we help make this decision. How would you make this decision? What do you think? Anybody? The kitchen mop, pink shirt? What do you think here? How would you make this decision?
I have a really different point of view completely. I'm not sure that I think survivability is where hope lies at all.
Okay. All right. So you've got your opinion. But, I mean, I think we need to look at the benefits and the burdens of the therapy. So when you consider the benefits, what are the hope for benefits? I'm not an oncology pharmacist, so if I get too deep in the weeds, I'm going to call an oncologist or a doctor to bail me out here. What are the hope for benefits here? What do we hope for? Best case. Sure, it'd be awesome, wouldn't it? Even if we can't cure, we have so many cancers now where we see like breast cancer survivors. It's a chronic disease now, so we can palliate the symptoms, we can extend the patient's prognosis. What are the burdens we worry about with chemotherapy? Oh my gosh, so I know like squat about lymphoma, so I looked it up last night. There are like 60 different flavors of lymphoma. So one of the most common is B-cell lymphoma. So I went to the NCCN network, webpage, which is the National Cancer webpage. So they talk about B-cell, the CHOP regimen, which is cyclophosphamide, doxorubicin, vincristine, and prednisone, which can make you lose your hair. It's highly emetogenic, so it's very likely you're going to be renal, not even throwing up. You get persistent peripheral neuropathy, which is nerve pain in your hands and feet and so forth. Then that was joined by Rituxan, which is another new medication. And then, you talked about 10,000 a month. The latter two drugs added are Dexar and Zevalin, which are $36,873 for two doses, or $52,540. So between the side effects and the costs, those are pretty darn big burdens. In doing hospice and palliative care, I spent a lot of time helping hospice medical directors and nurses and patients and families and caregivers make these difficult decisions about what drugs to keep on board and what drugs to let go. I think it's so important to have, I mean, hospice and palliative care wrote the book on the family meeting, like literally, we probably wrote that book. So I'm gonna sound like my friend John Cagle down at the end of the table here, because even pharmacists know enough to say, what do you hope for? What do you fear? What's one thing I can do for you right now? That's so important. I tend to be pretty nihilistic about chemotherapy. I can say that right now with a straight face because I don't have cancer. But I imagine if I did get cancer, my two drug regimen would be a continuous infusion of chocolate alternating with butter. I want to share two quick stories and then I'll pass the mic about two patients from my primary care practice. And I saw them both last Monday. My two residents were with me, they know it too. One is a 70-some-year-old woman who I take care of for her severe rheumatoid arthritis pain. And about a year ago, she was diagnosed with local breast cancer. So I said, well, what did the oncologist say? She said, she recommended chemo. I said, so are you going to do this? She said, oh, no. So this is a religion seminar today. She said, Jesus will take care of me. I'm a good Christian woman, but I'm thinking Jesus is going to need a little chemical assist here. I said, did you take one of your adult children with you? No. I said, well, I would just encourage you to take one of your adult children with you when you meet with an oncologist next, so you can get a better idea of the benefits and the burdens of just doing nothing and hoping Jesus will take care of it. She looked at me like I was a little crazy. So then the other patient, so now a year later, she has wide metastatic disease. The other patient is a 50-year-old man in his late 50s with severe COPD, and he's got a lot of neck pain and back pain from car accidents and so forth. And he's got severe COPD. Well, he was diagnosed with lung cancer. So I said, well, did you talk to the oncologist? Yes, I did. I said, did you ask the important questions? And he said, well, what are those important questions? I said, you need to ask, what does he recommend? And then, what is your life likely to be like as you take this medication? And how likely is it to take care of this cancer? And he looked at me like I was out of my mind that I would even have the nerve to bring that up. And I know that patients are very, very respectful of their healthcare team, but I see that as one of my biggest roles, is encouraging patients and challenging patients to challenge their healthcare team to ask those hard questions about the benefits and the burdens. Being a hospice person, my other favorite phrase is aggressive palliative care. We have lost our minds in palliative care. It's an exploding area of research, and maybe we can bring our A game and say, look, we are absolutely not giving up. We are shifting the goals of care, and our goal of care here is aggressive palliative care to keep your wife comfortable. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Diane Hoffman from the School of Law, and it's also just really a pleasure to be here. And I just also have to say to Rabbi Silver how much I appreciated your introductory remarks, the stories and the framing you gave us about mortality as a gift, I think is a really good perspective for us to all in thinking about this issue. While some of you may wonder, what does the law have to do with this issue? Hopefully, not a lot. Hopefully these kinds of issues get resolved between the patient and their family and loved ones and the healthcare team. And the law doesn't really, or lawyers at least, don't have to step in. The law more broadly, though, does provide some background rules and processes for us to think about in these cases. So what does the law do? I know it's set up to resolve disputes if it gets to such a stage that disputes are somewhat intractable. It's also, though, designed primarily to prevent disputes and to set up procedures and rules and standards that help us make decisions along the way. And the law cares about certain things. It cares in these situations about patient self-determination. That's a huge part of our law, you know, our background, constitutional law about the rights of the individual to make decisions for themselves. That's part of our culture and our history that's embodied in our law. But on the other hand, the law also cares about individuals who are vulnerable and need protection. So if those things are sometimes in tension in the law also cares about fair process, fairness, and I'll also say it cares about justice. Now, I was speaking on a panel like this before, and I said briefly that the law didn't always care about justice, and I think I know that there was a physician in the audience who later told me that he quotes a lawyer who said the law doesn't care about justice. I don't want to be quoted that way, but I'll say a little bit more about that later, because there's different kinds of justice and fairness, and there's process, which when there is a dispute between parties, we want to make sure that fair process is used. Fairness in outcomes is sometimes more difficult to achieve when you have competing values and competing goals. There are certain state interests the law also has, things like the preservation of life, but and that can be balanced with this other issue of the individual's rights to self-determination, individual dignity. Those concepts are very strongly embodied in our legal framework. So what does the law say about a case like this? Well, the lawyers, again, to the extent that they would be involved in this, really have to rely on the healthcare team, because a lot of the background rules require medical expertise and expertise of healthcare providers to interpret and apply. A lawyer can tell a healthcare provider what the background law is or rule, try to interpret the law for them, but they're generally in the position to have to apply it. And I'll share with you what that means going through this case. But in terms of a case like this, the law basically codifies what our previous speakers have already said in terms of what we looked at. The first thing that we would look at is what would the patient have wanted? And here we, is the patient competent? Are they going in and out of competence? Dr. Brand mentioned they can't speak, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're not communicative. Are they at times possibly that they are responsive and can understand? If so, we want to find out what the patient would have wanted. Ideally also, as you said, some of that conversation would have happened because it seemed like a fairly long process in terms of her decline and one could kind of see what was going on here. Even if so, assuming that she can no longer respond, her husband under the law is, there's a list of people, and also she does not have an advance directive, and we're assuming that she doesn't, that would state the kinds of things that she might want in this situation. Her husband is going to be her spokesperson. And the law, though, he's insisting, or he says, according to the case, that he believes he is obligated for her to get continuous treatment. I would be wondering what is the basis of his thinking that he's obligated to do that. The law actually said it actually has things that a surrogate should be thinking about when they are trying to figure out what is it that the patient would have wanted. Things that, again, Dr. Brem and Professor Cagle mentioned. But what were their expressed preferences, if any, regarding this kind of treatment? If they didn't say anything about themselves, had they did she have parents that went through any kind of disease process or chronic illness, or friends who went through a dying process where there were questions that came up about what kind of medical treatment they would want? And did she comment on that? And does that shed any light on what she might have wanted? The law actually mentions in considering what a patient would have wanted relevant religious and moral beliefs and personal values. What did she believe about life, her purpose, and afterlife? How did she view death? To the extent, again, that these things can help determine what she might have wanted. Sometimes those general beliefs, you can draw different conclusions from them, but sometimes they may be more specific to help figure out what she might have wanted. The law actually also includes, what did she have any expressed concerns about the effect on her family or intimate friends about her if treatment or is provided or not provided for her? So it asked to for her husband to think about, you know, what impact is this having on, it doesn't mention, I don't think, that whether she had children or if she ocean babies. So how that would necessarily affect the baby, but those are things that you can think about in making this decision. But if there isn't enough information, you don't really, can't really establish what she would have wanted, then the law looks at best interest. And this is something that Dr. McPherson talked about, which is really defined as what are the benefits and burdens to this individual of continued treatment or withholding of continued treatment. And again, the law has a list of things to think about when we think about best interest for her. What each of the kinds of treatment we're talking about, what would they mean for her prognosis, for her degree of physical pain or discomfort caused by the treatment, or the withholding overall of the treatment, to the degree to which the individual's medical condition affects. The law talks about would it result in the impairment of the dignity of the individual by subjecting the individual to a condition of extreme humiliation and dependency. So again, she's not unconscious. She's seems to have some maybe responsiveness in and out. Is she someone who would have wanted to have to be so vulnerable, so open to, you know, the prodding and pulling and changing of things that go on in this kind of high-tech treatment? Or was she more, would have never wanted this kind of invasiveness and maybe infringement on her privacy and her dignity? So the law doesn't tell us, though, how to weigh these things. The husband may view the benefits of treatment as huge and what they will, and that they will maybe keep her alive for some amount of time. But it may be helpful to talk through with him these different kinds of factors. If he is not persuaded that continuing treatment is not in her best interest, then the question becomes whether her physician would consider any of the treatments, oral medication, placement of gastric tube, or CPR, as medically ineffective. Each one of these treatments could be thought of differently in that respect. Generally, the law says that physicians need not provide treatment that is medically ineffective. Physicians don't have to provide antibiotics for a patient with a virus. A physician doesn't have to provide Lyrica to a person with cancer. These are things that we know are not effective. There's no law that requires a physician to do that. Things get a little trickier, though, when we're talking about end-of-life care. I should say the law in this regard is statutes and laws that have been decided in cases like these. It's all, you have to look at individual state laws. So different states have taken different approaches to this. So in Maryland, the governing law here would be our Health Care Decisions Act. And it says, it does say that a physician is not required to provide treatment that is determined to be medically ineffective. It defines medically ineffective treatment as treatment that to a reasonable degree of medical certainty will not prevent or reduce the deterioration of the health of the individual or prevent the impending death of an individual. It's a very narrow definition. It's basically there's no medical benefit to continuing the treatment. In this case, the patient's attending physician and another physician have to certify, that this was medically ineffective. And the thing that is a little bit problematic for some in Maryland is that there is a kind of an exception to, even though you don't have to provide medically ineffective treatment, if you tell the patient's surrogate that that is your decision, and the patient continues to, disagree, the law says that you need to continue to provide, or first of all, the physician can say you can try to transfer the patient to another institution. But if pending the transfer, failure to continue to provide treatment would result in the death of the individual, then the healthcare providers need to continue treatment. So that has been a problem for some healthcare institutions. We can talk about it more, maybe the section, the question and answer and discussion at the end. I will say one thing that the law, when I talked about justice before, I talked about fairness. There are two different kinds of justices. There's reciprocal or corrective justice. That is when you have a dispute between usually individual parties, the kind of things that go to a court. And then there is distributed justice, in which we talk about the allocation of resources among different groups in society. And both of these issues come up here. The law generally is most concerned with, if you go to court, with reciprocal justice. When I said at one point before that the law doesn't care about justice, the law, at least in the courts, don't really get involved in distributed justice, taking resources from one person and giving them to another, generally or broadly. That's the role more of the legislature in terms of the policy. So I'll end there.
Okay, thank you very much. And now we'll hear from the nursing perspective.
Right. I'm going to go with a few slides. Okay. So we know here that in ethics involves values conflict. These are a few of the values that are in conflict in this case. Stewardship of limited resources is sometimes separated. There's a distinction between rationing, I'm going to put a little timer on so I don't go over, and not wasting resources or allocating scarce resources like an ICU bed. But if we think about this case, we're really trying to figure out where we would place her right timing of her death, whatever that means, a way that she dies in a least bad way that minimizes regrets for those who survive, right? And we can err on either side, too soon, too late, waiting too long. And Rabbi Silber did an excellent job describing this unique relationship between our awareness of our mortality and how it influences our core beliefs, our morality, our traditions, our relationships with other people. But the problem is that we're in a death-denying culture, right? So people put off thinking about death, and as you get closer to death, the time that you have remaining becomes more precious. So people want to hang on to that. This is one of my favorite quotes. It doesn't matter how long your therapy session is, you always have your breakthrough 10 minutes before the end. So people procrastinate and then want that more time when they have less of it. So there's been different movements that have been trying to counteract this. These are just some of them. I don't know if people have heard of death cafes, death over dinner, celebration of life, writing an ethical will but that describes your values to leave on to next generations. And we'll post these slides so you can have these resources available on the conference website. Before I die movements, people writing down what they want to do before they die in public venues. There are different variations of this graph. So we've talked about on the panel the idea that when someone's diagnosed, let's say with cancer, Dr. Brehm gave a good description of this, you start out with a plan for curative or putting it in remission. You're providing palliative care to counteract the effects of the chemotherapy, but as you get closer to death, more of the care is comprised of this palliative comfort focus. You may or may not have hospice, which is a type of package of palliative care services that's reimbursed by Medicare and Medicaid. But what do we mean by comfort care then? So if you're getting that comfort only in the hospice box, this is Bob Arnold's description of comfort care. Preventing and managing symptoms, that might include stopping doing tests and blood tests that are very acute medicine oriented. Offering information about the dying process to those family members and loved ones that don't know what to expect. Figuring out what their religious or spiritual traditions and beliefs are important during that process. And then identifying those who need to say goodbye, particularly important for other children in the family. There's a way that can be done that's important. And then deciding where the last days should be spent. Is it really in the ICU that the person wants to die? Offering options if there are options. So this is also Ira Byock's Tasks of Dying, asking for forgiveness, offering forgiveness to others, thanks, love, saying goodbye, which we can see in hospice. People can linger on if they're waiting for someone from out of town to say goodbye to. This is what we don't want to tell people. There's nothing more we can do, which unfortunately patients and families hear all too often. And I would say that the toll a mishandled death takes on survivors in terms of negative mental health consequences, lost future productivity, diminished human flourishing, is as real a health issue as any other. So preventing these outcomes is not doing nothing. Okay? But what it takes, in addition to all the skills and knowledge you need that we've talked somewhat about, is an attitude, a sense of being emotionally present. If you're going to be in the presence of people who are going through this emotional roller coaster, you have to figure out a way to be centered yourself. This is a picture on the left here is Jeffrey Rothenberg, who was an OBGYN surgeon who had about 3 babies die 1 week and was starting to feel that sense of what am I doing and despair. And his wife is an art therapist, so she got him into glass blowing, and he now creates glass sculptures. There's a whole repertoire of mindfulness practices. The link at the bottom is Dr. Andrew Wales' breathing exercises. The 4-7-8 breath takes less than a minute twice a day, change your brainwave patterns, and allows you to be fully present when you have these difficult conversations that we've talked about. So in difficult conversations, I'm not talking about do you want us to resuscitate you when your heart stops. It starts as, again, Dr. Brehm said, you're drawing a map and you're saying anytime, let's say we get diagnosed with cancer, the goal is to cure it or put it in remission. We can take, there can be detours along the way. And what happens a lot is that families, patients and families have these worries. But they don't want to voice the worry because they're trying to be strong for the other person and they don't want to jinx anything. But then that eats away. That uses up energy, that worry. So if you can say, we want you to tell us what your worries are so that you can spend your time on healing, whatever healing means for you, and know that we have a plan. No matter which way we go, we have a plan and we're not going to abandon you. We're going to be there for you throughout. So that needs to happen over time. So where are the breakdowns in this case that we've been talking about? One of the problems is this idea of standard of care and consensus on standard of care going unrecognized. And we all know about this technology creep. The options available are limitless. And you might go to one hospital and they'd say, oh, we'll continue doing dialysis if someone is now in a vegetative state. And another hospital, they'd say, oh, no, we're going to go by the guidelines that don't allow that. Or even within a facility, you have different healthcare providers, different physicians, clinicians who do different things. It really wreaks havoc on the families and on the staff because they don't know what is actually allowed in the box and out of the box. So a remedy for this might be, you know, really applying what experts have already come up with as far as evidence-based practice, clinical guidelines, having team huddles. This is one example of a campaign by American Board of Internal Medicine of Choose Wisely, and you can look up that link later to learn more about that. This idea of variability in practice, changing staff, turnover, the need for interprofessional education at all levels, and getting buy-in throughout an organization. So it's not just the one lone clinician who's trying to change the world, him or herself. And then we've already talked about this idea of fragmented care. So I'm remembering this story. It was somewhere, a tribe in Africa, where they had a death ritual that involved basically drawing a line, and the coffin of the person who had died would be in front of the line. And the immediate survivors would be held back by others behind them, because the belief was that if they crossed the line, that they would die and go die with the person who had died. And so this idea of we need, as humans, a kind of a line in order to know where the barrier is for our grief, when we can give up, when we know that there's no more that we can do. The problem here is that we keep changing the line. And again, it's confusing for people. So let's just take one example of this in the remaining time here that I have. This idea of the CPR attempt. Now, again, unfortunately, this becomes the focus sometimes of these end-of-life conversations, which you shouldn't be having an end-of-life conversation that's focused on what you're not going to do. But that's what happens sometimes. And so there's this new kind of trend that, well, you know what, if a person's heart stops after everything that's happened before that point, they're dead. And we don't think that CPR will bring them back, if maybe temporarily, but probably not. If it makes the family feel better, why not? It's maybe a new form of death ritual. It's symbolic CPR that we can do to just make them feel better. So let's think of the different perspectives. This is like an imagined perspective. On the husband's side, you have to do everything. This is what, let's say he thinks this is what his wife would have wanted, okay? The staff's perspective, well, attempt to, even if she wanted it, it's not going to achieve the goal it was intended for, which the people that came up with CPR in the early 60s said we should never be using this as a default. This is really for people with sudden cardiac death. What about, I have to know I did everything possible. And the staff's perspective is that when you're shifting to care for someone who's dying, that the goal of care becomes more of dignified and respectful and compassionate care. So if the last act that you have to do on that dead body is breaking ribs and shocking the heart, it feels undignified. It feels disrespectful. I can't live without her. You're not alone. And maybe we have better grief therapy interventions than ritual CPR. So that's my own personal belief, is that symbolic CPR is not fair to the patient, and it's not fair to the staff. But we can talk more about that. There are a lot of people in the audience that are experts in one way or another. And that even if someone does want this full code status and they're dying, in that case, they still deserve what we just went over, or the comfort measures. They still deserve to have their symptoms managed, to have the family supported, to have spiritual religious traditions honored, and to have goodbyes facilitated. Just because they're full code doesn't mean we should, it's not all or nothing. And I think these are just some online resources that we can talk about in the Q&A or later today. Thank you very much.
I want to thank all of the panelists and Dr. Rappaport for the case presentation and the discussions we've had. We are entering the Q&A part of our program, so we do have a microphone up here, and we may have a roving microphone. But because we're a minute or two ahead of schedule,